So we're going to get started, and yeah, good evening, everyone. So I would just like to point you to the fact that we are, of course, experiencing an economic slowdown here in Germany, and that is obviously something that might be hurting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, because, of course, institutions and companies are shifting their focus to, you know, managing or diminishing the effect of whatever that downturn means on their budgets and also, of course, on their bottom lines. So I would like to welcome you to this evening's discussion, podium discussion, Equal Opportunities and Equality in Economics. And my name is Chipona Chimbelu. I am going to moderate the discussion here with these wonderful experts. And this discussion is, of course, part of the Humboldt University project, Equal Opportunities Intersectional. So welcome. And with me here is Monica Huseman, and she is a professor of human resources, organizational human resources, and information management. And she's also in charge of the International Business and Consulting course at the Berlin School of Economics. Thanks for joining us, Monica. And next to her, we have Sandra Subel. Sandra Subel is the Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion at Axel Springer AG. And right next to me, we have Lisa Ertel. And Lisa Ertel is an organizational consultant. And she is also a partner at Diversity Cartel, which is also where I know her from, because we get to work together sometimes there. So welcome, Lisa. And last but not least, we have Jeanette Trenkman. And Jeanette Trenkman is a professor of general business administration, and she is also the dean of the Faculty of Business Management, or Business and Management, just correct me if I say that wrong. And she is the faculty of the Dean of Business Management at the Business and Law School here in Berlin. So a warm welcome to all our panelists. So thank you for being here. So, yeah, thank you. And how this is gonna work is that we're gonna discuss the topic with the panelists for the next 40, 45 minutes, and then we'll, of course, invite you to take part, because we also wanna hear from you, wanna get questions, and of course, we also wanna get comments if you have any. So we're gonna start with the first question, which is, of course, the current economic environment. How is that affecting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts? Maybe Sandra, you could tell us a bit about your work at Axel Springer, or just maybe the people you move around, what that means.
Well, yes, I've got an opportunity to start, to set the tone. Definitely from what I observe and what we experience as an organization, there is an impact. Like, simply answering yes, there is an impact, and the question is what impact? I think what I've seen in the last 3 years since I've been in the role is this, I would say, this balance of interest in the topic. When the things are going well, suddenly there is interest in the topic. When the business is good, the environment is good, there are topics on the market that are driving the conversation, there is a willingness to do it. Because it sounds attractive, right? And especially when the diversity, equity, and inclusion are understood on the superficial level, like an event, or let's have a, I don't want to diminish the event, but very often D&I ends up being a conversation about events. Let's have a panel discussion, or it's International Women's Day. Let's invite some famous women, and then some other women to listen to that other famous woman, and that will be our D&I work we're doing, right? But that also costs money. And if the D&I is understood on that level, not on the systemic level, from the entire employee lifecycle perspective, this is where, which is favored by the good situation in the business, in the economic environment. The moment where the situation is shifting to being more challenging, the business is not as good, the topic is therefore being deprioritized immediately. And that's a situation where the D&I hasn't been embedded into the strategic work the organization is doing. And when I'm talking about strategic work, I think about people strategy, which should be linked to the business strategy. And I can only name or think about few organizations that have done that. And in all the other cases, you just push it away as something on top. And saving money, so no events, because that costs money, for instance. So basically, on that superficial level, we see those behaviors happening and taking place.
All right. I'm going to pass on the same question pretty much to Jeanette. And basically, we heard two words which also come up. Systemic is one word that comes up when you're talking about diversity and inclusion, but also business strategy came up. And you've been working in this area as well for at least over two decades also. So have you noticed any changes or shifts in terms of the economic environment and how D&I efforts are perceived and what happens to them?
Now, I hope that it's working. You can hear me. Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you for the question. I probably could start and never end, or we end tomorrow with this topic, unfortunately, we must say. So I've been doing research for quite a long time, and if you mentioned the two buzzwords, systemic and strategy, that's basically also what my observations are. So let me maybe start with the topic of strategy. That's sort of the imbalance or disbalance that you mentioned is, if you want, a paradoxon, because companies, and that's also what we teach our students, companies must see people's strategy really on the same level as business strategy, yeah? So on the same importance, not like having your strategy and then having a diversity department where someone is sitting and, yeah, you know, HR is dealing with this topic, then having some women on board, having some examples and employing people from different ethnic backgrounds and so on, and then that's it, yeah? So I think that's what at least organizations must have been understanding in the past decades, that sort of people strategy, including diversity and inclusion strategy, must be on the same level as business strategy. Otherwise, you would not be able to hire, and that's sort of where the paradoxon comes, the people that you need in the future or the competences that you need in the future. And then saying, when there's an economic downturn, not investing money because there's no money, sort of, you know, doesn't come to an end in the end. Yeah, you are not able then to have the competencies on board if you are not strategically planning on the long term. Yeah, and that's sort of the paradoxum I see. And you were talking about the changes or the lack of representation, and we don't only talk women today, yeah, we talk many different diversity dimensions. I don't know the public's, let's say, pre-knowledge in this topic. I know that we have a very diverse group here, as I see, so I don't know what you have been studying, but let's say the topic of diversity is not focusing so much on gender, but on many, many more different dimensions. And when you look at the economy, then you clearly see, okay, there is not the development that we probably in Germany want to see. Yeah, there's a slow progress when you look at, for example, women in leadership positions. If you look at the big, you know, corporations in the DAX, then it's a very sad view that you can see there. The development is very, very slow. There are some companies that have set goals for women on the boards and in management positions, but some have not set any goals and there's no sanctions. So there is a slow, slow progress in these corporations or in leadership positions. And when you look at other diversity dimensions like the education background, social background, ethnic backgrounds, people with disabilities, it's a topic that companies seem to pick up very, very slowly. Yeah, and my observation goes in the same direction. Once the economy is booming, then that's a topic that, oh yeah, you know, we could sort of add a little flavor on our strategy and like in Germany would say Feigenblatt, yeah, you show it to the outside and you show, oh, we are such a great, diverse company. And then if you look into the structures, if you look into organizational culture, it doesn't change anything in the people's minds. And that is sort of what we're really, and I don't want to bring solutions before we don't finish talking about the situation. But there you can see in the organizations that a lot has to happen because women are paid less than men. People with disabilities or people from other ethnic backgrounds are not included, or it's sort of some measures. It's not a systematic approach that that we can see in many of the companies.
And I think there is this pattern, right? When we are in a good economic situation, we are hiring, right? Hiring means attraction. Attractions means trying to tap into new target groups that are interested in topic, right? The moment that the situation or the economy slows down, the first departments that are being cut are obviously HR. Within HR, this is recruitment, right? It's stop recruiting, stop attracting. So, and this is where this vicious circle is being stopped for a moment at least.
Right, so it sort of starts in HR and stops in HR is what you're trying to say.
Unfortunately.
But we had a key word there, full stop. Oh yes, go ahead if you wanted
to. Just add something, yeah. Because I shared the observation that you've made, but there's one little thing that I also like from a consultancy perspective, so I'm the one the companies ask for help or what can I do, and in the moment they realize that the budgets are restricted, then the scale is trying to be reduced or the amount of money that can be spent on measures. But what I realize is that the awareness that it's a systemic problem is arose. So this is not anymore, like, we know that it is that the topic is a process, or that the dealing with the topic must be is somehow a very profound issue to a topic to tackle on, but we for the moment we don't have too much money to spend on what can we do to start on this journey. This is something that has changed, I would say. And not this kind of leaning back and thinking, oh, we have this event or that, or we did this little measure here and that this would be enough. So this awareness, I think, is somehow more on the top of rows.
You mentioned there the systemic nature of the problem not being recognized. I don't know, Monica, if you want to maybe add to that, or if you want to say anything also about the general climate that we have right now as well.
I think many people hope that with the shortage of skilled worker, we just tackle diversity as well, with the idea of there are not enough engineers, so let's take women, migrants, refugees, all who can do work as an engineer. Now we are in the moment. We are not. It hasn't really changed. So even if you see now, I think, around 10 years, 5 years, 3 years of a really clear shortage of workers, like the organization feel it. But I think if they would look at the whole diversity that's offering their jobs or their skills, you would realize that we still have skilled workers who are not hired or who are not hired and promoted. So with the hope that with this shortage of skilled workers, we tackle diversity because they need to hire them. We don't see this movement at the moment. I think many of us hoped with the idea, now you have to hire women, hire migrants, hire refugees, you have to hire all of them because you need them. It hasn't happened like that. We still see a lot of organizations who are waiting for the perfect worker that fits into same as everyone system. So still trying to find the fitting white middle-aged men who belongs to the engineer group, or the women with going into care. So there is still, we don't see that this problem has really had a big impact on this idea of diversity. And that was a bit, I think, a lot of people really hope for that, and we don't see a movement like that. And that's, I think, something you have to add to the problem. Even with this idea of we need them, we don't have companies, or some of them, but really not all of them, who would, I think today I did discuss with a recruiter and consultant who said it is still, I have a women specialized a baker, and she won't get a job in the area because she has blue hair. And we still, we can't put the hair in front of our bakery. We can't stay, give her the job selling things to people. People won't accept that. And I think blue hair is not a big thing. I think we all agree on that, that blue hair is not the diversity category that makes everything difficult. But we still have this idea they have to be like they always had to be. And that's something with coming back to the problems in economy we have. And with nowadays the shrinking numbers of recruited people, adding that we still see a growing problem for society as well.
Is this a question of framing? Is it that companies are unable to frame the problem differently? Because obviously they look at diversity and inclusion in a certain way, and they haven't quite changed the way they perceive it. And in order for them to maybe get it right, they need to reframe it. What is it? Perhaps one of you could take that. I don't know.
Monica first.
Monica,
I can see
that. Okay, Monica first then.
I think if framing would be the solution, it would have been done. So it's reframing things is not the most difficult thing to do. And if that would help companies out of their feeling of shortage of skilled water, would help with diversity, everyone would do it and we are out of the problem. So it's a very deeply rooted problem in society, still very close to roles, very close to power, very close to dominating, very close to this idea of who gets the money, who gets the better promoted job, and it's about money, power, and domination. So a bit bigger than a frame. So,
yes, Sandra, you wanted to add something.
You ask for a problem, and I think the problem is that the organization do not see the problem. I think that's the problem. I think I'm like using a lot of self-explanatory concepts, but what I observe, there is still a willingness to reject that something isn't right. And it's hard to start a conversation where your counterparts at the table believe that everything is okay because it is always like that.
I think maybe, Lisa, if I could just pull you in, just because you're also an organizational consultant, and I wanted to ask you, how do you get organizations to understand that there is a problem where they do not see one? What do you tell them?
Well, all these organizations are different. There are some, as I already told, that realize that there is a problem and that they are looking for an answer, but this is not too easy to find one. And this is a problem in itself, that the answers or like the measures that can be taken, there is no this plan A, B, C, and you tick the box and then it's done. But it's a very complex process of transformation. And I guess that like the people the companies that you mentioned, they don't want to see the problem. I think that they don't want to see the problem because it would mean a huge transformational process, and that costs a lot of money, energy, awareness, learning, and so on. And I kind of, this part of this rejection is really that, okay, there is a little bit of hesitation because I think that the people know already that this is a huge task and it's related to a very profound restoration of the way of how we work together and how companies and all these work environments are created or like based on. And so this is something that we all know somehow. It's not about folkloristic dinners or like coming together in a colorful manner or something. It's about trying to get to balance power. It's about like reducing discrimination or abolish discrimination. So it's really a very intense dealing with the way of how we behave as human beings, as we are in a social, like as mm-hmm. as individuals in a specific social context, as a team within this responsibility of the organizational context, as a context of how we meet, how we live together. And so I think this is what we should explain, that diversity is not like this easy going or like, or what needs to be understood. that it's not this easy net of having this colorful get-together, mm-hmm. but that it's really a matter of social justice and of equality, of equal opportunities and so on. And this is something that when you talk to people, nobody wants to discriminate, no? Nobody wants to kick people out, but we have to understand that this is the way our company or the institutions, the organizations work. It is somehow intrinsic, it is implemented in the way these organizations work, and this is part of the task that I feel I need to explain, and I want to explain that this is important.
Yeah, I think I fully agree, and I think you've touched on the important point of change, right? And that is a huge change that organizations have to undergo, and we know this popular saying that people are afraid of change, or we as human don't like change, and I think it's not as much as not liking change or being afraid of change. We're more afraid of loss because the change is bringing some losses. And in case of D&I, it's a loss of privilege. And that's a conversation very difficult to have because it's uncomfortable. It's not a win-win.
And yes, there's no win-win.
It's not. And losing privilege and fighting to keep it, this is invisible dynamic that is taking place. And it's not even about organization. We're talking about individuals that are composing that organization. So we're talking about Peters, Franks, Matthiases, or Thomas, you name it, Christian, all of that, or also probably Bettinas quite often, and so on. Sandras, or you name it, but it's a difficult part.
I think, Jeanette, you wanted to say something before we move on, but
that's a good observation. Yes, sorry, I look a little impatient, probably. Yeah, no, I want to make also the picture a little bigger because we were mentioning the organizations that are trying hard to find people for certain positions and functions, and then the other hand, if you look at the job market, I mean, it's you looking for a job, going on a job market. You are in the most comfortable situation that you can probably find because you can look for the job that you really want, and the question is why don't people want to work in big corporations? Because they don't find what they are looking for. They don't find diversity. They find Thomas and Hans and Christian, and that's really, there are studies, there's research on, in German we call that the Thomas Kreislauf, so the circle of Thomas recruiting Thomas, yeah? If you are in the board of management, if your name is Christian, for example, you have good chances to become a member of the board of management in a startup. Yeah, that's also what research says. So there's more people called Thomas on boards of management than women on boards of management. And if Thomas recruits Thomas, what happens is that if individuals recruit individuals that are similar age, similar social background, similar educational background, then of course these people shape these organizations. And as long as there is not maybe, there's also research on how many women do we need on these boards, and often the number of 30% is sort of what people agree in research. As long as we don't have a certain number of, for example, women or people with a different color or people with a different background in the decisioning positions, they won't be a circle recruiting these people. Yeah, so that's it's not going to work for itself as long as we don't have these people in these organizations. So then the question would be, what makes organizations so attractive that you say, oh yeah, that's a great workplace for me? And I choose this organization. And so there's the topic of change again. Yeah, change is pain. No one wants change. But if you look at the job market and you say there's so many skilled people and education is, you know, I mean, the academic level and the academic quota is growing with education. So organizations have this big potential. And if people don't want or are hesitant to work in big corporations because they don't see, you know, how they can use their skills and really see diversity, inclusion, they see their representation, then that's also a problem, yeah, that people don't want to work there. Corporate culture is a thing, yeah, organizations are not attractive enough because people's minds don't fit with probably what you look for at a job market or at an organization, yeah.
I would like to add for this also the point that it's not like someone is coming maybe with a different gender or background or sexual orientation, and they get the job and they are happy. The moment you start with inclusion, they want the same money, they want the same position, they want the same career. So it's not, inclusion is not we are in big harmony and we all are singing in the same rhythm. It's about fighting because we want the same things. We want career, we want money, we want promotion. And you fight against people that you maybe would have liked to avoid. So it's not that inclusion is harmony, inclusion is fight. It's also the idea if people come in an organization, start there, and they are just happy to have the job, that's not inclusion. That's maybe a start. But inclusion would be, we don't want to be just in the same room, we want the same table, we want the same cake, and we want the cherry on top. And that's also a thing, diversity is not something that's peaceful. And everyone is happy with it. It's about fight, it's about wanting the thing you have, and it's about changing things. And the same with women on board. We have had some women go, or quite a big range of women, going into board of directors, seeing that, experiencing the topic atmosphere in this many boards of directors, and leaving. So we have had quite a growing number of women starting to go there and just want to drop out again. So it's not just about recruiting, give you the chance to start. It's about options, it's about career, it's about money, it's about power, and it's about more. So it's not a peaceful stop when you recruit people. It's about things are happening, and that's something you can be tired sometimes. I think, yes, we have to go through this thing, because at the moment you still think, why should this woman get my job? It should be like, I don't want her and him to get my job because it's mine and I'm better. But we still try to find, identify the women, the gay one, the lesbian one, the everything, all characteristics. And I think we sometimes mix up diversity with this happy multicultural harmony and we all sing together. And we have to get rid of this picture in our mind as well.
I mean, a couple of keywords came out there. It was uncomfortable, not harmonic, or it doesn't, you know, it's not about people. There's a lot of fighting as well. How can you convince organizations to do all this work? Like, where do you start? Because it sounds like a whole lot of work, because of course it's not work that just organizations should be doing. It sounds like entire societies should be doing this work. So where should they start? And to make it at least easier and simpler for them to get into it, where do you start? I don't know, Sandra?
If we had an easy answer, then we probably would not need to sit here, right? Is that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you have some experience or things that you could use, and maybe you could help us with tips and solutions. You mentioned solutions before, so yeah.
So how I understood your question is basically, Monica, draw a picture for us of diversity coming with a luggage of benefits and disadvantages, right? And it's about comparing which side has more, so to say. And I think that for me, the starting point is on realizing the benefits of doing that and seeing the benefits of getting on board for that constructive disharmony. Because I think we need to realize that not every work will benefit from diversity, right? I mean, diversity is a fact, right? But when it comes to routinous tasks, I don't know, folding boxes, pizza boxes, the diversity won't improve that process, right? The outcome of that work is the sum of the hours spent of each individual. But their jobs, which are not routine, is not repetitive, but complex, especially in the context of solving so-called wicked problems, which are really requiring a knowledge from different fields and knowledge that cannot be gained by one person, right? Because we all have limits. It's not like we can, the times of those people who could study all the books probably finished around 15th century, and now we really need different capabilities, different lived experiences, right? We talk about cognitive, on the one side, on the cognitive diversity, which can be fueled by the identity diversity. So when the companies realize the benefit and they see the connection of what they are producing, offering to the market, being a digital product, being a service, could benefit from having diverse set of employees who are delivering that, I think this is a starting point to decide, yeah, it's worth getting on that journey of discomfort, disharmony. I'm not a big fan of the word fight, because it's, I mean, maybe that's better describing the reality, but it's also polarizing. And polarization, sometimes it's beneficial, but I think the word is polarized enough. So I would, maybe a constructive disagreement, Monica.
I want to throw this to Monica, because you have some research as well when it comes to competencies and what different groups can bring. And maybe you could just tell us a bit about that and what that means for diversity and, you know, equity and inclusion.
I did some more. At the moment, I'm finishing my research on competences of people with a non-academic background with an own academic degree. So if you come from a family where no one has studied and you are the first studying, so that's describing the group I'm looking at. And I realized, because I belong to that group, so I'm reading other research and ideas, and sometimes I was a bit annoyed when I always read, we have to be trained like that, we need to add some more knowledge, we have to learn how to behave in a certain surrounding, where I think, yes, some of it is true, but still, people with a non-academic background bring other competences to the table, where they, what they can offer. So, looking into my research, I did long biographical interviews with 27 people from this background, and they told me about their whole career, some of them till retirement, thinking about the idea, what did you gain from your background? So, and they added things like resilience. So I had to fall, and I had a lot of disappointment or a lot of failure in my life, but I always had to get up again, because there was never a family I could go to, because, and they are rich and I can just stay there. They did talk about things like, I can talk, I'm now a manager, but I can talk with every person in this company because I come from a background, my mother herself was a cleaning woman, I can talk with a cleaning woman just from the spot in a respectful and supportive way. So there are competences like this, resilience, empathy, ability to communicate on certain levels that you can find with people with a social background like that. It's not that everyone is bringing that, and it's not for sure, and it's not something other ones couldn't gain. But it still is the idea, there are also competences you have to see, and not only shortages. Things they miss, things they haven't done, things they haven't experienced in family. So if you look for a competence-oriented approach, it would be also to open in a company the mind for other competences like empathy, like working with people from different backgrounds, talking with people in a very direct way, being able to deal with money on a day-to-day level. That was also something they said. I had to count my money over all studies, over all time, because it was always short, and I never had this idea running to my parents and telling them I need 2,000 euros. Because they would start laughing and talking about something else. And so this idea of a competence-oriented human resource policy is something I'm talking about. And it's not only people with a non-academic background. It's also about what bring women, what bring men to the table, what bring people with a migrant history in their family, what are different experience, how they form your life style, your competences as well. And if you start to respect them more with an idea of we need a composition of all these competences, that would be, from my position, a very important thing, because then you just don't, you don't only focus on you miss this or that, or your German is not as perfect, or your, so you don't have in mind that there is one set of competences that's important for all. It's the composition of different competences, like Sandra said, you can't have all of them in one person, it's not possible. And you can't read as many books to know everything. So you need this composition more and more. And if, from my position, it would be a good position to integrate and invite more people with a different set of competences.
All right. Do any of you want to add to that? Because we're talking about solutions now, so we just...
I'm nodding all the time, so it's like I can sign everything that you
say. A competence-oriented
right.
approach in human resources.
Yeah,
what
that's
other
definitely
approaches
an approach,
could we
yeah.
use?
I just made up my mind, or I just was thinking also while Monica was talking, and you said, Chiponda, you mentioned also efforts that not organizations must bring, but also society, politicians. Yeah, I think so. It's a joint effort. And I mean, companies have been trying to install diversity, I think, for the last 40 years. So it's the 1980s where the first diversity managers popped up and where, you know, companies had suddenly departments that took care for nice websites with, you know, people with different colors on it. And that was sort of the beginnings, and organizations were thinking, oh, you know, if our website looks nice and diverse, then maybe we also attract people. But it didn't change anything within the organization. Yeah, that was the point. So last 40 years, voluntary measures, nothing happened. And that's why organizations have been forced to install quotas and so on. And I think, I mean, probably when you ask yourself, are you a fan of quotas, of like fixed, measurable or numbers that lead to measurable outcomes? And maybe your mind changes when you see, okay, there have been no results if this is all voluntary. So probably you have to force companies. And I think I'm a big fan of quotas because I think they can bring some results, and probably you need them for some time, and then you can sort of skip them again. So, and you were also asking for, is there anything like low-hanging fruit? Yeah, what can companies do to really bring measurable results? And because we come from economics, we come from business administration, we really like to measure everything. Yeah, that's maybe also, I can't do anything about it. And I think that when you, for example, take, I just have 2 points maybe for low-hanging fruits, and then also 2 more for like the long-term sustainable results. So if you take the gender pay gap that still exists, women earn less than men, and it's a very consistent of, now it's less than 20%, but it's still 18%. Yeah. So if you are a woman and someone is doing the same job and he's a man, then you can, then you know that this guy earns 20% more than you, or you earn 20% less, however you want it. So, and research has shown that transparency can bring really results. Yeah. So if organizations reveal their salaries connected to the jobs, then something like that has no basis anymore. Yeah, so that could help to overcome the gender pay gap, and really taking care of that and making that transparent. That is what would be something that is relatively easy to install. And then the second thing is that is, I think, more the individual level that you could also do something about, talking about biases, yeah? Everyone has a bias. Everyone is biased in, when you see someone, you have a clear or maybe not so clear idea of how this person would probably behave, yeah? If this person is white color, has a certain age, has a certain habitus, yeah? Certain way of behaving, or has blue hair, yeah, and you sort of the machinery starts, and you have stereotypes, and making yourself aware of, okay, I'm also biased. Would I maybe employ this person? Maybe not because of blue hair. So what happens in my mind? Yeah, so talk about biases, and then really seeing okay, how can I overcome this bias? First of all, being aware I'm also biased, and then trying to overcome this can help a lot to make objective judgments about persons, about you know, things that are really important and are strategic. So that is something that I would say you can just like this, I can't do it, yeah? You can really do in an organization. That is more low-hanging fruit. And then in the long run, I think it's not the individual level, but it's the structures. Yeah? So organizations really have to look at how they can build structures that would attract diverse people, how they can really go away from this individual focus. Yeah, someone needs certain to be in a certain function, you just have to be this and this and this, and then this is your position. Yeah, but also the competencies approach, and then organizational structures can change, and the organization itself will change. Yeah, so organizations do the effort together, politicians that have to take care for the framework conditions of, you know, child care, elder care, your job, your family life. Yeah, all of that is, I think, also where politicians can do something about it. And then society itself is also, I think, requested to be open, and also, I mean, if you think about biases on an individual level, that also would change society if that would be something that everyone would do. Yeah, so that's probably my two cents for maybe looking at a solution or seeing something. You know, I could go on with corporate culture and yeah. So there's so many, I think, points where we could start. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a very long list. I mean, dissertations have been written about this. Lisa, if you wanted to maybe just tell us what your quick fix would be, or quick fixes would be. Exactly.
Microphone, sorry. So there were many like words or ideas I would can easily connect to. I think that, like, from this consultancy perspective, I think that we somehow have the task to translate this very complex idea of organizational change or transformation into a way that can be adopted by companies. So this very difficult issue of, wow, this organizational change, but we need this organizational change, and it's like there is this individual level aspect, there is a team, like collaboration level, and the structural level, there is organizational culture that is touched on the basis. So, and this is, from my perspective, it's a task to translate this very complex concept of systemic changes into a very practical manner. That would be, and this is something that we are at Diversity Cartel are kind of engaged in doing. So finding a program, finding a model that translates these complex transformational tasks into a, yeah, kind of a tangible version of what to do, what answer on this question. What can we do now to bring it down? And maybe one thing for, like, that, because it connects to the very beginning of the discussion, because I think that we shouldn't tap into the trap of like separating these challenges of demographics, of climate change, of racism, and so on, like, or not, like, just separating or like slicing it in different pieces, but thinking it together, like having all these challenges and taking the potential that goes within diversity, or having the different perspective, having various approaches on how to solve problems, like taking really this the DE&I potential into the, like, to solve all these very complex challenges we're facing now. So not to separate this idea of, we need to prioritize this or that, but not thinking it together, maybe, as a quick solution.
I don't know how quick it is, but I think it definitely might be more effective. That's another story, of course. Quick and effective are not always the same. But we've come to the part of the discussion where we're going to invite you to take part. So the audience has the opportunity now to ask their questions to anyone on the panel discussion or just to say what you think. And I'll just remind you that your voice will be recorded if you ask your question via the microphone. However, if you choose to not to want to have your voice recorded, that's perfectly fine. You can still ask your question, but you may have to, then we'll do it differently without the microphone or something like that, and someone will repeat the question on your behalf. If that's what you prefer, that's also fine. So, and you're also welcome to ask your question in German as well. Most of us here do understand German, but we'll also translate it directly into English so that everybody in the room gets to know what's being asked or said. Anyone? All right, we do have one.
Otherwise, we start asking you questions.
Thank you very much for your insights. I guess I have two questions that maybe relate a bit mostly to what you said earlier, but I'm sure you can all answer both questions. One is what you mentioned. I really like the picture you painted with the cherry on top of the cake. Like, you know, it doesn't stop at just, you know, hiring people. And I thought immediately that you could also phrase this as with it comes responsibility to, you know, once you hired someone, for instance, you know, someone from abroad who moved here, whose visa depends on the job, you know, maybe you also have a kind of different sense of responsibility once the company faces difficulties like a massive layoff. You know, you probably should include in your equation of like who to lay off first also these things, or shouldn't you? Like, that's one question. And then another question is, how would you translate this? Because we are in a university and we also discuss a lot of this in the context of being employed at the university, and how, and I think the organization and the structures here are very, very different to the private sector. And a lot of the concepts or things you studied are, I think, taking place most like, or considering the structures of the private sector, and how would you differ in like what you recommend to universities?
Not easy. I think if you compare universities and private organizations, there are big differences, but still it is in a structure, thinking of the structure, we still have the same need for diversity. And we have the, I think you could force universities more into reflecting what they are doing, or it should be possible to force them more to reflect and to realize their biases, but we still have in university a lack of quite many groups of our society who are not represented here. And that is a big problem, because I think we are still ignoring that Germany is not a dominant white German country or culture in that regard. We are a growing diverse country, and we need that, and we should invite that as well. So we need representation on all areas, in politics, in universities, in education, and in economics. So I think it's addressed to more stakeholders in that area than just universities. And it's addressed to politics as well, to, for example, get rid of this short-time contracts in universities, that you can get more security, that you can be also as found a family when you're young and in university, that don't really fit together, and even not for women and not for men if they want to take responsibility in that area, because no one is, we don't discuss that openly, but no one is really accepting that you have a pause and maybe coming back without this, I commit my whole life to my research. There, if there are children or people you care about, you can't do that, or you don't want, and you can't do that as well. So universities need to reflect on their way of thinking about work, thinking about contracts, and thinking about their responsibility to represent society as well in research and in lecturing.
I can pick up on the other question on recruitment. And I mean, the quick answer is yes, it should be taken into consideration. Why? Because there is a problem. We see it a lot in the data from the time of COVID and how women and members of non-dominant groups have been impacted, especially in layoffs and the consequences of, especially of so unpaid work of women in the household and how women were impacted by the time where the work was shifted or not shifted. The work entered our households, right? Before COVID, it was optional. During COVID, it was a new reality. And the same applies to the other diversity dimensions, and members of non-dominant groups were impacted. And how to do it, I think, particularly in Germany, I see a big role that a well or future-oriented Betriebsrat could have a role to play in that. I'm not German, and I don't have the full grasp of the role of Betriebsrat
in Works Council.
Works Council. Yeah, that's one of the first words I've learned in German, just after Steuerberater and Steuererklärung. But at the end of the day, I think this is something that it's a very important tool that those entities have in the organization and can step in to support, right? Especially when it comes to massive layoffs. Of course, the social factors are taken into account. The topic of race or gender, it's not part of that. But I can imagine there are tools to be leveraged for that because there is a problem.
Yeah. I don't know, would either of you...
Yeah, I was just like, yeah, thinking about this very, like, relative, like, or yeah, in comparison, very traditional, conservative field of university and these strong hierarchies. I mean, there is this very good article of Asle Vatansever, like, about this sexual harassment case here at this university. I really appreciate the way she kind of pulled out and everything and connected the situation at universities to the hierarchies or the strong power imbalance that easily leads to abuse of power also. So especially in universities or in this context of these hierarchies, it's in like extremely visible in how far these power relations are important to look at. So this would be, and yes, like, I would say I didn't have only the private sector in mind when talking, so it's really like having this organizational change process also is absolutely necessary. And I come from a public administration context, so I know quite well so yes, it fits quite well. Yeah. Too many. Yeah, you also.
I couldn't agree more with what you said, Monica and Lisa. Yeah, so it's true, right? The strong hierarchical organization, as such, as all state universities are, doesn't make it or makes it easier, as you said, to have this power imbalance abused in a way. Yeah, and also the problem of these limited short-term contracts. I mean, who in the economy would accept a contract that is just limited to 6 months and then it's getting extended again and again and again, and then, you know, salary doesn't change, you don't have any other benefits. So who would work for such an in the private economy for an organization? Yeah, so. And I also agree to Monica saying universities must change their understanding of work. Yeah, it can't just be top-down approach. You have this strong hierarchy, and you, as a young researcher, are the least smallest point in the system, doing all the work, and then sort of being not able to design your work or to design your way of understanding of work. Yeah, that's also the conditions that must change, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. All terribly interesting. I have a question about quotas, but it's a more general point about supply and demand. So, you know, we're economists here, so supply and demand. Labor markets are have the result of some equilibrium, and that is where supply and demand meet. But when we discuss regulations, we almost always discuss demand-side regulations and never supply-side regulations. So, you know, when you say quota, everyone here in the room understands this is a demand quota, like a company has to hire at least such and such percent higher, and not supply, not offer, right? So now we're in the university system, so my question then is, should we, why is there no pressure on the universities or on companies to say at least such percentage that you offer to the market has to be of a minority group, right? And that's not just for universities, it's also for companies, like, you know, every company has some kind of training or mentoring programs, etc. But I've never heard of any of that discussion, although it's, you know, it's just the other side of the market. And, you know, if demand is short, are we sure that it's always demand that it's short? I don't think so. I think, you know, many of the times supply is short. So why don't we, you know, work there?
That's a very good question. Do you know any, do you have any research on that you have read? Or, because I think that would be at least a good point to start researching on that, as long as there is no
I mean, but many of the research that you know, I'm sure, sort of touches on it. So, for example, we had last week we had a seminar with it, or 2 weeks ago, was talking about the different willingness of women and men to go into group leadership positions. Okay, so then you can say, you know, I don't know whose fault it is, but clearly there is a supply aspect to that, right? That and then, you know, we're talking about the geographic mobility of people. So, you know, in connection with the university employment laws, if you have to change your geographic location at the age of 35 or 40, that's maybe differently hard for men and women, right? And that's also a supply issue. So, you know, maybe we should make sure that, you know, at the right age, we supply enough people of the right kind to the market, right? So many of these things. But the pressure is always on the hiring, on the recruiting team, is never on the training team.
Isn't it a bit of a chicken and egg problem? Because I've heard the statement on, or there is not enough women willing to take up the position of leadership. And I think this is a difference of a lack of interest versus understanding the reality where the role operates in, right? And as also was mentioned before, there is enough stories of people who try to enter the battlefield, I think it's the right word in this case, and step back from it. Because the rules of the game are not prepared for those players. And it's not only about women, but it's also for people with disabilities, neurodivergent people, right? So the battlefield is prepared for a prototype. And the society is not built out of prototypes. So I think we have to also not only supply the men, but we also need to work on the playing field and the rules of the game. And I think what resonated with me from your question is the point of the pipeline, right? Because it's another common argument, especially in technology, that there is not enough women that we can recruit. And I think Germany has the highest ever female participation in the STEAM environment. I think this last year it was 37% of the third year students of the STEAM subjects were women. So it is improving, right? It's not 50-50, it's not balanced yet, but it's an interesting topic. And now I will speak for the space of partial knowledge, right? Because we're talking about the regulators coming in. We know the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive that will force businesses, and I'm not sure, Marta, will business or academia also be forced, or public sector will be forced to report on CSDR? Maybe that's a gap. Maybe the EU should also expect the public sector to report on that. And that could provide some, that could be a lever for more transparency.
Yeah, I want to add something. I think we've seen that in the 70s, there was always the idea of women are not qualified enough for this labor market. women have picked up this idea. We have seen a lot of qualification at the moment. The share of students, female students, are bigger than men in most areas. We see that if you take the 10% of the best ones, the best grade ones, we find at the moment 2 or 3% men. So the dominating group with the best grades in education system are women. We don't really see that this development has changed a lot in the hiring process. We still see that men, even with worse grade, with a lower level of academic knowledge or things like that, still start in organization with a higher income. We have this idea, seeing, looking at other groups, we see that things are changing, and I think this argument towards women, you need more qualification, you need to study more, you have to be more prepared for the labor market today. That was not always, that didn't really change in the idea of women getting a better start into organizations. We see other effects. If you look at now you have to help me with the English word.
Veterinarian.
That was in Germany a long time protected by the grades of the people starting to study it. So we had a change in the 80s. So nowadays, around 70% of the ones studying this
veterinary,
that's really like, are women.
An animal doctor,
thank you. I can handle that word. So we have on the labor market a growing number of women highly qualified in the area, and what we see at the same moment that the income is dropping. So we see with a growing number of female animal doctors, we have a dropping income in the same area. We saw the same with IT. We were a dominant female group when it was a very technical thing and with a very low income. With the IT, the personal computer started, we had a takeover of men in that area and a really running income in that area. So we don't see that. If we change it, we can't change it everywhere, and we don't have number for everything. But we have number for the animal doctors, and we have number for the IT, with the idea of a gendered profession, and that if you go with a change in a gendered profession, we see that women still earn less and men still earn more, or the other way, if they're leaving, we see a dropping income. So there was always an eye, not in all areas for sure, but there was an eye on this idea with especially women, you need more qualification, that hasn't changed. The entrance barriers for women, and in the end, not, I think we can't stop with recruiting. We don't see them in the high position in the percentage where they start with qualification. So we see that it was tackled in that area, but we don't see the changes. We see a really resistant to change system that we have to tackle at many, many levels, and this will be a tackling point for all the time for sure, but it's not the one from my position.
All right, any further questions, more questions? Yes.
Hi, my name is Rajiv Desai. My pronouns are he, him. I've been in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space for about 8 years now, and I think this is the first time I'm doing an event in a chapel. So thank you for making that happen. I'll give all of you a little bit of a break, and I'll just add to all the amazing things you've shared and not ask you a question, which is, you know, we started the evening with the focus on the economic downturn and the expenses. And, you know, working with a lot of smaller organizations who already have low budgets, one of the things we found is that there needs to be a shift from what I call expensive programmatic efforts to more behavior and process change, right? It's very easy to buy a membership to a gym. It's very hard to go to the gym, right? It's very hard to go work out. And I think we have to have a shift in our organizations around behaviors and processes. You know, a lot of you mentioned recruiting as a process. The latest research shows that 40% of candidates don't even apply to a company if they don't see enough evidence of DEI, right? So you can change your process all you want inside the company, but these folks are not even coming into your process. So I would really encourage all organizations to really audit each and every process within the organization to look at it from a DEI lens and say, okay, where can we make small incremental changes so that the entire process improves for a better outcome at the end of the year? And that's an easier sell to the executive committees than a large DEI budget. So thank you.
Thank you.
I would just be, I would be interested in how useful the discussion about diversity in politics is, because when we're talking about diversity in politics, there's a lot of regulations, there's laws around for people with disabilities, there's certain laws around it. I'm just wondering if these measurements are useful in any way, because pushing companies into having a more diverse hiring, if you already mentioned that having a diverse company and getting to that point where people with disabilities are welcome or are feeling safe in that environment, are able to work properly, does it make sense to push legal regulations on these companies even though they're far away from having a company which is able to properly give a good employment to a person with disability or from a different background or whatever? So do these political measurements make, or that political discussion, does that make any sense, or is it more counterproductive?
I don't know if you wanted to address your question to any particular panelist. Okay, it's for everyone here. Sandra, you go first, because I can see you already.
Well, as the data shows, it's not very effective. As you brought up the example of people with disabilities, right? We know the threshold for the organizations, at least in Germany, for those that hire above 20 people, it's 5%, right? And the World Health Organization estimates the number of people in the world to have a disability for about 15%. So the threshold is set quite low, 5%, 15%. For those who don't know, if the organization do not hire the 5%, there are penalties. The problem is that they're too low. So it's easier to pay than solve the problem. And solve the problem, it's on many levels. Sometimes it might be about physical accessibility to the building. Sometimes it's about provision of accommodation. Sometimes it's about transparency of the process. But at the end of the day, it's easier to pay the penalty and keep things as they are. I think this is quite the example of people who are bringing diversity. They also are disrupting the harmony, which I think is a great thing, but in the eyes of many, it might not be such a good thing. So I think the current regulations are not enough. And I think there is a lot that can be fixed with regulation, and I think regulatory actions are a strong lever for change, but it has to come with other, let's say, efforts, including empathy and other perspectives. Yeah.
All right. Any further? Okay. I think there's one question there and there. Oh. Okay. Then you go ahead. Let's see if we can get the mic to you.
I want to build on what Sandra said, because I'm involved in the introduction. I'm part of the task force that in our group is introducing, I also work for Axel Springer, and I'm part of the task force that is introducing the new EU directive, CSRD, which is a new also reporting standards for the companies that makes equally important sustainability data and financial data, and they're being expected to be reported together at the same time. There can't be any delay. And not all, and answering your question, I think not all the KPIs that are described in the standard are useful. not all of them will bring a lot, because there is a lot about the equal wages and person with disabilities, diversity metrics, and some of them, sometimes I look at them and I'm like, well, this is such a poor KPI. But the fact that there is such a big directive and such a big push that you need to report on so many points in the area of governance, in the area of social, and in the area of climate, makes the top leaders aware that they have to spend money on it, because there's a big requirement coming from the European Union. It will be audited and it can be penalized. So they at least start to noticing, oh, we need to hire a sustainability manager, or we have to introduce some reporting procedures. So it's not perfect. Often it's, as Sandra mentioned, with the very low penalties for the number of people with disabilities. But I think it is, sometimes there's the stick that big business needs to actually look at least at those things.
All right, Monica.
I would like something to the protection for people with disabilities. I think we often concentrate on the fact if they hire them or not, but mostly it's about keeping them in the company where they gained their disability. So around 90% of all disabled people gain their disability during their life, in and very often during their work life, maybe not always connected to the work life, but they gain it over the time. So it's about you work somewhere, you get disabled, and then you are protected by laws in many regards in Germany, so you can still stay in the company. And it's, we discuss very often thinking about the disability laws in Germany, thinking about recruitment and that you have to talk about it or are allowed to ask or things like that. And there are still quite some disadvantages around it. But the biggest group that's direct or that's tackled by this law is about people gaining the disability during the working life. And there, if you think about that, you get most of them get it between 20 and 80, and the biggest group between 40 and 60. And that's very often closely connected to what you're working and how hard you are working physically. And you can't get rid of them as easy in Germany. And that's something I think we have to be aware of when we talk about this kind of legislation as well. So it's not enough, I would agree immediately with Sandra, but it's something at the moment which I think people can very often stay at the place where they are working. And in a public institution, it's even more difficult to get rid of them. So it's a bit more protection because of the public situation, how to hire and fire there in Germany. And that's something I think we just need to be conscious of. I quiet down, yes.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for all your insights. It was very interesting. My question is a bit longer, so I hope I can express it correctly. But yeah, I was wondering about parental leave and child penalty, because from what I heard and read in papers, it's still very significant that women take longer parental leave and have disadvantages because of that. And from what I heard from like personal stories of people that I know, it's still also very stigmatized for men to take parental leave or to take longer parental leave. So I was wondering if this is changing, or like the mindset is changing in companies, that it's also eligible for men to take the same amount of parental leave as their wife, for example, or if that's still a problem. Because I would imagine if like maybe men and women would take the same amount of parental leave, the child penalty could also be lower for women.
It's a great chicken and egg topic, because as we've heard many times, there is a gender pay gap. Women earn less. In Germany, the law is quite clear about the financial benefits during the parental leave, right? There is a threshold, which for many families, it's not enough to sustain the group, right? So the choice is usually quite binary. Either we have money to live or not. And if a woman earns less, the choice it's I want to... I'm tempted to say the choice is obvious. We see the reverse, and at least in my circle, just on a slower scale, in my circle, in the couples where a woman earns more, you see women coming back to work earlier and men staying at home. And I think talking about different regulations that can be helpful, we see a good example of, I believe, Norway, that work on the topic from the taxes perspective. And it's encouraging families to equally split the parental leave between both parents. It's because I think here it's not only the binary gender thinking, through penalization of taxation. So like it's not convenient from the financial perspective. It's only one person takes that time off. So those are a couple of thoughts from my side.
Yeah, that's true. It's of course a taxation issue if you compare because it's sort of easier as long as we have Ehegatten splitting. Yeah, that sort of the wife is the model for okay, you stay at home because you earn less, and that's beneficial for everyone instead of taxing families and not just taxing couples. You know, because if you have kids, then it's getting worse even. Yeah, with the taxation issue. So there is, because you were asking, is there any change? I think it really depends. That's also the question that the answer that I also suggest to my students always. It depends. It's always a good answer that you give. It depends really on the size of the corporation that you look at. What larger corporations, and probably, I don't know how you experience that with Springer, but larger corporations often have a stronger or a process that is institutionalized that really looks after if someone is leaving the company for parental time, for taking care of parents or whatever care tasks there are, then there is a process in place, and that's institutionalized in bigger corporations, how to really make this leaving the company and coming back smooth for everyone. Yeah, in terms of training, in terms of further education, in terms of when the woman wants to come back, then there's no gap in, okay, I have to restart all over again, where in that time when I was at home taking care of the kids or the parents, men were sort of taking the lead and they are in far superior positions now, yeah? In smaller companies, you don't see that, and you see a growing number of fathers taking this parental leave. That's at least some observation. And what is also interesting, the gender pay gap is almost non-existent when you look at the age distribution. So up to the age of 29, women and men almost earn the same, and then the gap starts. And that's, of course, you can guess why, because that's the 29-30 is the age when women have their first child, and then the gap starts. And bigger companies are, at least in a trend, able at least to take more care of not making the gap too large or not making the time of leave too different from when people then want to come back, yeah, and are probably able to give more incentives and to, you know, stay in closer contact. That's at least my observation.
Yes, Monica.
And I think you also should look at society as well. This idea that mothers who give their child in a very young age to even the partner of the father, or public education system, we still judge on them in a very societal way. So I think we still have a society that tries to keep this mother idea in a not on a individual decision level, and it's still something we have. When I, even with the pandemic, we have a rollback into quite some conservative role models to think, looking at couples with children. We had a change with the idea of care work, distribution in couples or with couples during the pandemic. Women took much more responsibility for children compared to men. And I think we have to deal with this idea of this rollback into this kind of women are there for the children, men are can go and play soccer with them, something like that. We still have a society that is pressing men and women into certain roles. And I think we have to see this societal background as well, because the pandemic has really sharpened this pressure towards both gender, or even if you don't see it as a gender thing, or if you see that, that couples can be diverse as well, you see that very often one of the two is pressured into being more into a mom role, the other one more into a father role, and that's always combined with a certain expectation of societies. And I think that's something we need to be aware of as well, that there was a rollback, and if we want to get this space more open again, we have to fight that as well.
A picture came to my mind that is quite viral on Instagram currently of those social roles Monica just mentioned, like when the father brings fast food home, he's labeled as a fun dad. When mom does it, it's a bad mother. And that goes with other examples. I think it kind of yes. builds on that.
Elise, do you want to say something? I thought
it's a little bit the same, like it's worth questioning one's own biases and stereotypes and so on. It's really something very crucial. We see that at this point. I don't know if it's really a rollback or if it has always been like that and got clear during the pandemic that these roles have never been kind of, that liquid as it would have, would be good, would be nice for yeah. realizing life chances. So. But it isn't the case. Maybe it's a rollback, maybe it has never been like that. But looking at that quite clearly, what is in our mind and what combines roles, and this kind of restricts the I already found that word in my like this the opportunities to realize these life chances of so many people. And this is what we should like really think of as much as possible, what is already in our minds. What restricts us and others while doing our things. Maybe.
So, you talked a bunch about this gender pay gap, and we also talked about issues, what we have implemented to make it easier, for example, for female persons to have child cares and child education and all these issues. And you also said that we have a shortage of labor supply, that we don't see that still female women get hired for higher positions. And you also said that even if female women are hired at high positions, they often drop because they feel uncomfortable. And isn't this also an issue because at some stage or for making a career, it is important this networking. So not only the skills that I can do some qualified work, but networking. And this networking, in my view, that's why Thomas hires Thomas, because Thomas likes to talk to Thomas and not to somebody else who is not the person he can talk about his hobbies or things like that. And so how can we solve that? Because this networking issue is, I think it's very, very important, and I don't see how we can break it in such a way that female persons feel comfortable in positions that are male dominated. I even could imagine in a shortage of labor supply, the female persons who are very, very smart and attractive, they go to female companies where they can make a career in a female dominated company, and that's why we will never be able to break that up.
That's a very good, yeah, thank you for your comment. Definitely, I would totally agree that networking is a big issue. And as you say, in companies that are male-dominated in leadership positions, it's an issue that the effect of not having to leave your comfort zone, but looking for your, you know, for exactly your counterpart. So Thomas would then hire Thomas because it's nice, you know, this guy that has the same background. It's great working with this guy. So why should I, you know, hire someone where I'm not sure about the outcome? It's a, how did you call it? I have to look it up. It's a constructed disharmony that I suddenly have when I have more diversity on board. That's certainly true. And what can be observed is that exactly what you were saying, women tend then to look really for DEI and how is it represented and how are women networks probably already established in companies and go there and decide not to go into these big corporations, yeah, and because they just don't want to do such jobs when they have no support and when there's no network. So I think there's a lot of great initiatives that take these issues of women that should be networking. Probably there's no one, you know, global initiative that that spans for all the needs of all the different women, but there are networks, and that is also an increasing number. And I think it's something that you see that women also understand that networks are important, and that's why they organize more and more also in these networks. Yeah, I think about Panda, if you probably know, it's a big network that has more than 3,000 women connected, and if a company looks for someone in management positions, then they could actively go and search this network, and women, you know, they organize events and they support each other. So I think that's a very important point, yeah, definitely.
I think here we also need to think about the definition and the format of networking, right? Because if you take it in the traditional form, what is networking? After work drinks, golf over the weekend, and as we already discussed, and the social norms and responsibilities are different of different genders. So if by definition we know that there are tasks that are handled by a woman at home, she simply cannot afford attending the golf with colleagues on Saturday, where socially it would be more accepted for the father to do that, or staying long hours, right? I always recall this moment from my workplace where we had one of the leaders becoming the father. And when he was leaving on time work, everyone was praising him for being a good dad for picking up a son. But then when a woman was doing that, like the label was, oh, we cannot rely on her. Like she's leaving on time, right? So we see a lot of that. And if we want we need to think about more inclusive networking. Right, and doing that during the work time, for instance, and enabling people with, and it's not only gender, because there are men with caregiving responsibilities, and it doesn't have to be a child, it can be an elderly parent, a disabled sister or brother, right? So we all have responsibilities that we don't see, and the formats, again, are created for an ideal prototype.
All right. It's 8 o'clock, and if we're going to be very strict, which I have to be, because normally I work in TV and there is no time, the show just goes over and there is no way you can do that. You run into a bumper and that doesn't work. So we're going to have to end it now, the discussion. I think you should join me in thanking our panelists, Monica, and of course, Sandra, Lisa, and Jeanette for joining us this evening and sharing their insights. Maybe a warm hand of applause for all of them. But that also goes for you, the audience. Thank you for your participation and for staying for the ones who are here until now, 90 minutes, you know, which is a long time. And you do have an opportunity to network with everyone who is present and who decides to stay for the reception. So I hope I see you over the drinks at the reception. So see you there, I hope. Cheers.